You know, plants may have more to do with a crime scene than you might think. Larry Mueller here. Today we'll talk about forensic botany with our two guests, Sarah Hotchkiss, Sarah, professor of botany at UW-Madison. She's an expert in pollen identification. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, great to have you here. And Alex Wiedenhoft is an adjunct assistant professor of botany at the UW-Madison and is team leader at the Center for Wood Anatomy Research. And Alex, welcome to you as well.
Thank you for having us.
We'll talk about how criminology benefits from the study of plants. We'll touch on pollen and wood identification. We can get into illegal logging. I think some of that even happens right here in Wisconsin. I'm pretty sure it does, and certainly in other countries as well. And we can talk about other applications of forensics as well. So I hope you'll join in. You may have some questions or comments about forensic botany. You may have an experience to share as we go along. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. You can send us an email at ideas@wpr.org, or go ahead and post a question or even a photo on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. So forensic botany, is there a good definition for forensic? I think I've sort of described it, but did I do a good job of it? Well, what do you think, Alex?
Well, normally when we talk about forensic botany in our course that we're teaching through the botany department,
which sounds really cool, by the way,
we're having fun with it. This is our second time, and so we're developing it as we go, of course, and making improvements along the way. But we really talk about four different aspects of forensic botany. The obvious stuff, the things that people think of, are what we refer to as the applied criminal forensic botany. So looking at forensic evidence, botanical evidence from a crime scene, and very much like you'd think of in terms of a show like CSI or something.
Sure.
To that effect. We also talk explicitly about the ability to use forensic botany in a civil context. So outside of criminal law, but in civil law, where it might have something to do with product contamination or other claims about things in commerce. And then we also talk about forensic-like inquiry, where we use the same science and the same reasoning, the same techniques to process information and evidence that have nothing to do with a crime or any law. It might have to do with an archaeological context or studying past ecology. And then lastly, we talk about also this influence or interference zone between science as it can inform and alter law and policy. And if science interacts with law, that's where you find forensics. So
wow.
When science informs policy and law, then that's another form of forensics, just not the traditional one that we usually talk about.
That is really, really cool. Sarah, why is botanical evidence useful for criminal investigations? I guess I could see some applications there, many actually.
Actually, one of the reasons it can be so useful is because people often don't notice it. So it's not something that somebody would try to avoid or cover up. Pollen just sticks to things, and it can tell a story about where those things have been over time, depending on what was blooming nearby or what pollen had settled nearby. So botanical evidence is often just along for the ride. So it's telling a story about where something has been.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And plant evidence or plant materials can be useful as well, aside from the pollen and so forth, I would think.
Absolutely, and really it depends on the kind of context that you're investigating. If the question is whether or not a suspect was present at a crime scene, we could be looking for things like pollen and other forms of trace evidence, so small pieces of physical evidence that would adhere to a person. But botanical materials can be part of the crime. You can have them be either part of how a body was concealed, for example, or a weapon, or a range of different contexts. And then it's also maybe worth mentioning that forensic botany, the study in the field of botany, is more than just plants themselves. Historically, it's always included fungi and bacteria and algae and pretty much all of life that isn't animal life historically. And because of that, we at least touch on those topics in our course as well. So the purview of forensic botany is pretty broad.
Yeah, it does sound like a really cool course. But at the same time, the person probably needs to have some pretty good science background to take a class like that.
So I think the science context of this class is really important for students. The focus is on evidence and on uncertainty about that evidence, and that is useful in every piece of life. You know, just evaluating evidence is just really important to develop your skills in, and it's a very sharp context for science when you put it in a legal situation where the rules for the burden of proof are very clear, either better than 50% beyond a reasonable doubt is a very strong evidentiary standard. In science, we keep track of the uncertainty. We discuss the uncertainty a tremendous amount, and this course puts that in sharp relief.
Yeah, interesting. Well, relating to that, Tim in Eau Claire has a question, I think, so let's go there. Tim, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, I do a fair amount of woodworking, and one of the things that I look for is spalting in a piece of wood, so like spalted maple or something to that effect. And I'm wondering what sort of clues spalting might be able to give you towards a crime or something like that.
Hmm. All right. Alex, what is spalting, by the way?
Sure. Well, spalting, I'm not 100% up to date studying spalting itself, but spalting is essentially a place in wood where different either strains or species of fungi that have been degrading the wood meet and set up these accumulations of biochemicals between them, kind of like almost like little barrage zones where two fungi are kind of fighting it out in the wood, or at least that's a useful way to kind of conceptualize it. And something like spalting, I think we could talk about this in two different ways. One, you could say it could be a real detriment because you have these microorganisms living inside the wood and destroying the wood as they go along. And so they're reducing the wood information that's available, whether it's structural or possibly DNA evidence, something like that. On the other side, if you were interested in, if you had a piece of a spalted wood that broke off from some other object, you'd be in a really good place to be able to match those back up if you had spalting lines, because the chances of having a piece of wood of the same kind with the same spalting line in the same position matching up with the growth rings as well is virtually
impossible.
Nil. Yeah.
Oh, that is very cool. Well, and by the way, you can join in too if you have a question or comment. I hope you will at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. You once, Alex, identified the wood from a pool cue that was used in a murder. Tell us that.
Yeah.
About that.
So one of the things, it's a caveat that I want to address at the outset. When you do forensic work like this and you're involved in the laboratory actually looking at forensic evidence, sometimes, in fact, frequently, we don't get the entire story. So people will submit evidence to us. And in an ideal case, like, for example, with the pool cue case, they had the known murder weapon because it was a broken pool cue and it was presumably bloody and left in association with the victims. And then they had a suspect who had some small fragments of wood on their clothing. And they were interested in this question of whether or not those fragments of wood could be definitively associated back to the known murder weapon. And in an ideal world, what we would have happen is we would have the investigators or the detectives submit us not two specimens, not just the known weapon and the material from the suspect, but ideally we'd get several with some dummy specimens thrown in with no identifying information for us, so that we're purely processing the material from a scientific standpoint, saying specimen A is this, specimen B is that, or more specifically, as Sarah has mentioned, talking about the uncertainty a little more clearly. And so say what we find with specimen A is consistent with this species, specimen B is consistent with this, and so forth. But when we do this work, sometimes we don't actually know the full context of what we're working on, and then it's common that we don't find out what the answer is at the end, or we don't find out what the result is through the legal system, whether someone was convicted or acquitted or what have you. In the case of the pool cue, it really was just, from a scientific standpoint, fairly routine, just looking at small fragments of wood, determining what kind of wood they're from, and then talking about whether or not that's consistent with the murder weapon.
Wow. Did you find out what happened in that particular case? You don't have to tell us, but...
Well, I know, from the wood standpoint, the material on the person's clothing was sugar maple, and the pool cue material was also sugar maple. And sugar maple is a common wood for pool cues, and if memory serves, because this one goes back maybe almost 20 years, but it was a case in Texas where you don't find a lot of sugar maple just in somebody's yard to account for ending up with some chips of wood on your shirt. So I think they had the sense that that was fairly damning.
I would think so. And you've had some other criminal cases you've worked on. You did something, didn't you, with the Drug Enforcement Agency? There was some raid on MDMA synthesis.
Yeah, this was, for me, this was a very educational case because my background, of course, is in botany and wood structure and wood anatomy, and not really in the legal aspects. But the DEA had specimens from what had happened was they had a suspect who, apparently, according to the story that they told me, that the detectives told me, they knew fairly well that this person had been engaged in drug dealing for a long time. And what they were interested in doing was catching them at manufacturing and distributing this MDMA or ecstasy. And you can actually extract an oil from certain plant roots and use that as a precursor in the synthesis for MDMA. And you can go on the internet and look up the biochemical steps for synthesizing MDMA. And so what happened was they raided their suspect's home, and the instructions for the synthesis step by step of MDMA were pasted up on his kitchen cabinets one step at a time, with the materials for each of the steps collected beneath each step. And so they were, honestly, I don't usually use this word of law enforcement officers that I work with, but I think they were, you could probably say, almost giddy with how pleased they were that this was going to be a slam dunk case. And so they had a burlap sack of plant roots, and it was labeled right on the bag sassafras, because it's the sassafras oil that you can extract as a precursor for MDMA. And they had internet receipts for buying sassafras roots. And so they had come to my laboratory and they said, all we need is to know that this is sassafras and we're done. And so they brought in the bag and we opened it up, and I pulled out the first root and took a look and knew there was going to be a problem, because I'm a specialist in wood structure and wood anatomy, and what I pulled out of the bag was not wood. It was something more like a lily tuber. And they're not tubers, corm. See, I'm a terrible botanist because I really focus on wood. But the underground structure from some kind of monocot like that. And so I looked, I cut it, I confirmed anatomically this is not a piece of wood. And we ended up bringing the specimens over to the botany department, UW Herbarium, and talking to specialists there, because it was well outside my ken. And people then in the department, in the herbarium, were able to identify that it was probably a species of smilax. And smilax is the source of sarsaparilla. And so we're thinking that somewhere along the lines, this common name confusion between sassafras and sarsaparilla happened. And so whatever this person was concocting in their kitchen was not MDMA.
Oh, man, what a great story. Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to continue talking about, we probably got some more stories to talk about, too, but this whole area of forensic botany with our two guests, Sarah Hotchkiss, professor of botany, and Alex Wiedenhoft, adjunct assistant professor of botany, team leader for the Center for Wood Anatomy Research. Give a call with your questions or comments. Number's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at email at ideas@wpr.org, or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. I'm Larry Mueller. Lexi Brode, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at around 11:45 today, we'll be talking about water-saving gardens with the author of a book titled The Water-Saving Garden and how you can use your yard to replenish your local aquifer. So that coming up at 11:45. Right now, taking a look at this whole field of forensic botany. I find it very interesting and intriguing. And hope you do, too, and I hope you have some questions or comments for us, maybe an experience to share. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Sarah, let's turn back to you. Pollen, is pollen the major area that you study?
I'm actually an ecologist who studies the history of ecosystems for my research. So yeah. I study anything that falls into the mud from an ecosystem and might tell us something about the history of that ecosystem. One of the main things is pollen. You can look at a cubic centimeter of mud and find a couple to 500,000 or 600,000 pollen grains in it. Pollen is so abundant. And pollen is beautiful. The structure of the pollen wall is just absolutely lovely. And different genera of trees like pines and oaks and maples make pollen with different shapes and different decorations. So we can identify the tree species from the pollen. And the mud can, or the remains of clothes can really give us quite a detailed picture of the trees that we're standing around, especially.
Yeah, I seem to remember one of these CSI-type shows where they used mud to locate pollen or whatever they could find in the mud off someone's shoe to locate where that person had been, because the pollen was quite specific to an area.
Yeah, it's more likely that you would be able to exclude a possibility using pollen than that you would be able to make a definitive match, but it's an excellent source of a large amount of circumstantial evidence that can contribute to an overall picture.
What about aquatic species, let's say algae? Can they tell you much about a crime?
Absolutely. Algae are specific to areas of lakes, and they differ from lake to lake, and they differ in different terrestrial contexts, too. So they can tell you something about provenance. Alex, maybe you can say something about algae and drowning cases.
Right. Well, I know one case that we haven't actually reviewed yet this semester in class, but that we've talked about in the past, where there was a group of children that young people that murdered another child, and they were able to associate the culprits with the particular lake where the body was found, even though they had claimed that they had not been there, by actually looking at various types of algae and their relative abundance and comparing that to other local waters. And basically, like Sarah said, we can use evidence like this typically more powerfully to exclude something. So you say, I was at place X, and your trace evidence and your botanical evidence does not support that you were there at all. And that's part of the process of using forensic evidence. Oftentimes, I had a colleague, a law enforcement colleague, who told me that As much as he appreciates the access to scientific information, really what he needs to do his job is an excuse to get people talking and catch them lying. Mm. And that's one piece of what forensic evidence can really do in kind of the non-Hollywood sense and the non-CSI way, and in a more realistic way, to help investigators target their approach to finding explanations that are consistent with the scientific facts.
Really interesting. I wonder sometimes, you know, these shows might last an hour or whatever, and typically in seconds they figure out the answers. Does it take more time than that, Sarah and Alex? Sarah, maybe you first.
Oh, it depends on the case, you know. Yeah. It could take... In Alex's case, it could take seconds to identify a scrap of wood. It takes me an hour or two to thoroughly assess a pollen assemblage, and a day or two to prepare it to do so.
I was thinking there's one sort of area, and I'm just thinking back to stories I've read in the paper or even shows where people have been murdered and hidden somewhere. And can botanical evidence help you identify, say, hidden or clandestine graves?
Absolutely, yes. It's a little bit macabre, but there's a fairly robust literature out there in the scientific literature and the forensic literature on the influence between disturbing the soil and how that changes species composition, and then the process of decomposition of whatever you've buried, and how that influences the soil and chemistry and availability of nutrients, and how those things can play out in the context of finding a grave. But the question of clandestine grave discovery is really more of an ecological one.
Yeah, so, soil profiles change very much if you mm-hmm. dig up the soil and mix it around and stick it back down on top of something. But then after that, you can recognize the difference in the soil profile over a grave versus not over a grave. But then you can often for many, many years see the legacy of that disturbance in the plants that grow on that surface, in the patterns of fungi in the soil. Everything changes, and the stronger the microscope you use to look at it, the more and more and more lines of evidence you can accumulate that this little patch of soil was disturbed, 2 feet away it was not.
And people have a day-to-day appreciation of that. If you've ever been responsible for trying to keep your lawn nice, if you have anything happens to the patch of your lawn, and for whatever reason you have to dig it up and try to replace it, you try to reseed, you try to do any of that, it's quite a process. It can take some time to go from whatever your disturbance is in one small area to getting it to look like the rest of the lawn again. And that struggle and some of those biological factors are analogous to what's going on with the disturbance associated with a grave.
I think there was a patch of lawn in my childhood that remained a source of evidence for my entire childhood. I wonder if something was buried there.
Somebody's hamster,
or maybe there was just a big rock under there somewhere that was affecting it. But I suppose, all right, so if you've got somebody who's admits to killing somebody 5 years earlier and burying them in a certain area, you could probably may be able to go to that area, and based on what you see in terms of the plants differences, you might be able to pinpoint a spot.
Well, that's the hope, and that's one of the pieces that we're trying to achieve with the course, is to reach out to students who have this academic experience that they're building by taking courses, and show them that there's a way that you can apply these things in real life. So like myself, I always joke I'm a glorified microscope attachment. I'm not useful in the field, so I couldn't go find a missing a clandestine grave. But if you had a naturalist or an ecologist or a field botanist from a given region and just gave them a 30-minute introduction on the sorts of things to look for and why we would worry about this, then you can tap into that existing knowledge that they have and that local expertise to be able to do this kind of work.
You know, we've been talking a lot about murders, but you mentioned earlier an area in your class you cover is civil law. How? Give me some examples of how that forensic botany comes into play in civil cases.
My favorite one, and maybe it's the Milwaukee boy in me, but my favorite one that I've done is actually looking at a question of wood contamination in sauerkraut from a sauerkraut manufacturer here in Wisconsin. And what happened was this sauerkraut company had switched cultivars to a different cultivar of cabbage that was producing much larger cabbages. And they were making their sauerkraut, and then they were ending up with this hard material in the sauerkraut that was hurting people's teeth, and it was being reported as a problem as some kind of wood contamination. And so the question was, is this material actually cabbage, or is this wood, or what's going on? And if it is wood, how on earth did it end up in this sauerkraut? And so they sent specimens to me at the Forest Products Lab, and we have the world's largest research wood collection. And I've at this point now, I've been doing this work for over 20 years. And so when that specimen came in, I cut it and I looked at it, and I could see anatomically it definitely was wood. And also right away I could see it was unlike any wood I had ever looked at before. And so I thought, well, it's supposed to be cabbage. And one of the little known facts out there is there are lots of plants that are growing in your garden or that are growing in the forest or off in the prairie that actually botanically make wood, but they're not what we consider woody plants. So wood is a specific tissue formed in plants or tissue system. And what we have is in things like sunflowers, the base of the stem in a sunflower, there are entire pieces of that are wood. Well, in cabbages, there also is wood that's formed. And so I thought, if anyone is going to have a specimen of cabbage wood in the collection, it'll be us. And so I went and I, in fact, found a specimen of wood from a cabbage plant. And I sectioned it and made a slide and compared the two, the unknown material from the sauerkraut and the cabbage wood, and looked at them side by side, and they really were a great match. And that led me to conclude that this stuff, in fact, was wood from a cabbage plant. And then, in an overabundance of zeal to be helpful and not thinking my way through this, I told the sauerkraut company, ship me some cabbages, and I'll dissect the cabbages, and I'll map out where the wood is existing in these cabbages. And they shipped me cabbages, and they came in on Friday afternoon after I had already left.
Oh.
And I got them on Monday morning, and they sat in my office at 80 degrees all weekend, and I still have documentation from this that smell like cabbage. I have to keep it sealed up in a plastic bag. But then I cut up these cabbages and mapped out the abundance and the position and the relative disposition of the wood in there. And it turns out that this wood in the cabbage, during the pickling process for sauerkraut, goes from being this stuff you could chew up and swallow and not even notice and have no idea was wood into this hard, tough material that was giving people trouble. So that's just a kind of a pleasant example.
And they probably went back to a different cabbage.
Oh, and that was for me, that was heartbreaking because I thought, if we give them the map of where the wood is, they can change how they core these things and stick with their new cultivar that they like. But instead, no, you're right. They switched back to the cultivar that they were comfortable with.
You know what? I don't blame them. I don't really blame them. Well, that's a great example. And you may have another one or two that I might ask you about, but I want to go back to timber because there, I've done some shows that have where it's come up that there's people have called and said I had 40 trees cut out of my woodlot, and that's, I quote quotes, it's a big deal to that person, but it's probably small potatoes compared to some. There's a lot of illegal logging that goes on, is there not?
Illegal logging is actually, it's a huge global problem. And the scope and the scale of it is really just starting to be appreciated as a global level threat to biodiversity, to economies, social justice, issues of sustainable use and management of forests. It's a huge issue that even in a place, as you mentioned, you can have what is comparatively small time theft of typically just a few trees, not acres and acres of trees that happens in North America, but in other parts of the world, up to between 50% and 90% of the timber output of some countries in tropical regions is illegally harvested.
Oh man, and that. So how does forensic botany? How do you work in that area, or what comes from that?
Well, there are lots of different ways that logged material can be illegal, and forensic science can only help solve certain pieces of those. So if you used a harvesting method or you built illegal roads and then harvested timber, all of that timber technically would be illegal. But there's nothing in the wood that tells us that you built a road inappropriately. So we focus just on those aspects of wood science that can tell us, that can answer questions about illegality when the information is built into the wood itself. So was it a protected species? Was it a... is it from a location or a provenance that would be illegal to harvest from? And those are the big two that we're trying to answer with forensic wood science.
That makes sense. And there was another case, I'm trying to remember something I read that you may have been involved in, with a shipment of, was it mahogany, something that, where there had been a value placed on the wood itself of about $9,000 or something.
Yes, I have that pallet in my laboratory, actually. So the genuine mahoganies, the Sweetenia species from the New World, all three species are protected by CITES. That's the Convention on the International Trade in Endangered Species. And because they're controlled by CITES, any import or export has to be accompanied by legal documentation ensuring that the country of harvest authorized the harvest and the export and so forth. And when this material came in, it came into the port of Detroit, and it was declared as some other wood, and it was with a declared value of, I think it was $8,950. And my former mentor who helped train me, he and I in the late 90s, early 2000s, published a trilingual manual on the identification of the CITES-controlled timbers from around the world, including mahogany. And the officers at the port in Detroit were able to identify these veneers because they were sliced veneers, so they stack back up in the same order, if you do it the right way, as the log. And determined that it was mahogany, and it came without paperwork. So there were two different things. One was it was an illegally imported species, and two, it was completely undervalued because I have it on the authority of a local cabinet maker, because my expertise is not in the value of timber at all, but that this pallet of wood is worth more like $250,000 rather than $9,000. So in that case, there, if we had known the value difference, there would have been a violation associated with tariff law, but then also it was a violation of CITES law.
So this forensic wood science is probably that has really played a role in shaping laws, the Lacey Act amendment.
In 2008, the Lacey Act was amended to include plants and plant products that are not food or horticultural varieties. And prior to that passage, there people associated with trying to determine how best to combat illegal logging were engaged in discussions with various wood scientists, including myself, about what is the state of the art of forensic wood science now, and now back then would have been 2006, 2007, and then what could we hope to be able to do if we had an investment in additional research and additional funding and really pursued these topics. And they incorporated that information about the state of the science into the shape of the language that gave rise to the amendment as we see it now. And so one of the things that the Lacey Act does that's different from the CITES laws, for example, and it's different from the way the Europeans have done things, is we have what's called a fact-based law. There is no magic piece of paper or document that can ensure that your shipment is legal under the Lacey Act. You're always required to engage in due diligence or due care. And so it requires the demonstration of the actual facts associated with the timber, not just a piece of paper, to give you legality. And that's a
great step forward then.
It's very empowering for law enforcement.
I would think so. Sarah, let me turn back to you for a second. What are some of the main challenges and limitations that forensic botanists might face?
Well, the botanical evidence isn't always there.
Yeah.
It falls off. If, for example, if you have a case in which you're given samples that that correspond to an alibi location and a crime location and other possible locations in the area, And samples from materials that a suspect was wearing, for example. Mm-hmm. The path the suspect took through those different possible contexts, they may have collected botanical evidence as they went through all of them.
Yeah.
The most recent context probably has most of the evidence, but the assemblage that's going of botanical evidence that suspect is going to carry is going to include little bits of everything else that person did that day.
Yeah.
Right? So you end up with a mixed assemblage that if they spent all day at the crime scene, you've got a nice clear distinction, but odds are they didn't.
if they were elsewhere. And then so the job is to take this pile, essentially, I don't know how, I'm trying to think of a way to describe it. Let's say you had a bag of marbles, all different colors, and you've got to look at each one of those marbles and identify what it is.
Right, exactly. And the crime scene would produce an assemblage of marbles of different colors on its own, and then each of the other possible locations would
have their own
bags. Right, which may have some of the same colors in different proportions. Points to one of the biggest limitations, which is that often the crime scene investigators aren't well trained in evidence collection for botanical purposes. So they may not present the forensic botanist with enough other samples to help them eliminate other possible contexts. So if we have only the pollen from the coat that the person was wearing,
but not their pants,
and pollen from mud at the alibi scene, you may be able to say that those are distinct, but not be able to put it in context of the world of possibilities. And so it's important actually for people who are on the ground to understand the collection of specimens in a way that helps to build the case or eliminate possibilities.
Really fascinating. You really have to be sharp and persistent.
Well, and people who are collecting evidence may be quite sharp, but not be aware of this range of possibilities. So.
You know, there's one, we're about out of time here, but there's one that I've got to ask him about this. Alex, you've identified a wood specimen from the skull of a saber-toothed tiger. You got to tell me about that, how that case came about.
Yeah, it's one of those things, as a plant anatomist, you kind of expect to live your life in massive obscurity and no one really be interested in what you do and not have many great stories. But I'm spoiled that way because wood is so important in so many facets of our life. In this case, it was a skull that was extracted from one of the La Brea tar pits. And I think... going in, I think everybody kind of had this hope that somehow it was like a spear shaft and somebody had, of course. And in fact, what it was a plant root that had made its way inside the skull of the saber-toothed tiger. So not nearly as exciting as maybe it could have been.
You were a wet blanket.
Yeah, that's, I get that a lot.
Sean on Facebook, by the way, wondered if you could, how much you've worked with on this white birch sapling thefts that were widespread across northern Wisconsin, or have you been involved in that?
I haven't.
Or can
been,
you
actually.
Comment on that?
Yeah, well, that would be a place where, because my understanding is that because they're using the saplings intact, that's a place where if we were able to survey the crime scene where everything was taken, we could actually, if it was in fairly short order, within a few months, we could actually get evidence on the size, diameter, growth rings, things like that of the stumps. And then if we had the bottom cut end, we could actually be looking at matching those back up.
So it's a possibility that...
It's a place that if they're the intervening pieces of wood, if anything more than the kerf between the saw and the stump and the harvested material, if anything more than that is gone, we really lose the ability to match it in any kind of definitive way. But if just the kerf is missing, we could probably make a strong case with enough material.
You guys have interesting jobs. You got to be smart to do them. I know that. But Sarah and Alex, thank you so much. It was a lot of fun talking with you today, and I hope we have a chance to do it again.
That'd be great. Thank you.
We had fun, too.
I'm glad you did. Sarah Hotchkiss is professor of botany and Bryson professor of climate, people, and environment at the Center for Climactic Research at UW-Madison. Alex Wadenhoff is an adjunct assistant professor of botany, team leader for the Center for Wood Anatomy Research. And I have a whole bunch more stories I could talk about here, or I could ask about. I shouldn't say I could talk about it myself, but I certainly could ask about them. So maybe we'll do that again. But you know how it goes. We turn our attention usually about this time of the day to other topics, and we are turning our attention to water-saving gardens. Pam Pennick has written a book called The Water-Saving Garden, How to Grow a Gorgeous Garden with a Lot Less Water. That coming up next here on the Ideas Network.